You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 83 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello! We have got so much to get to. We have one of my favorite third Pelton brothers ever.
Yeah, one of our stronger guests, I would certainly say. I don't want to say the strongest because
physically,
I don't
offend. He's imposing.
Yes. But we were thrilled to have, are we spoiling who's on it? People have already read this. They've seen it at the time. We're thrilled to have Sheil Kapadia, formerly of ESPN and now of The Athletic Philadelphia, on to talk Eagles and Seahawks with us. We'll get to that at the end of the pod. But first, let's start with a very special beer this week. And a thank you to, I guess not a third Pelton brother as yet.
He's a third Pelton brother.
He has not been on the pod as a third Pelton brother, but he's definitely a third Pelton brother in spirit. And that is our loyal listener, Tyler, who heard us talking about Jubilee cans a few weeks ago. And I think we said at that time that our favorite of the Jubilee cans was the 2016 version, the 2016 vintage that had purple cans, because go dogs. The full list, by the way, 2013 was kind of a light blue. 2014 was green. 2015 was red. Last year, purple. And now this year, I think gray, right?
Yes.
So little listener Tyler realized that he had some Jubilee cans in his sitting in his fridge from last year. He'd been aging them a full year and mailed them to us.
Yes.
Through the U.S. mail, which is an amazing amount of effort to go to, especially because literally later that day we ended up tailgating.
We would have drank them then, though.
I know. We appreciate it so much because now, to celebrate the start of the holiday season, we can crack open these bad boys.
He said he saw these cans in the like back of his beer fridge, and he was like, oh, God, my foamed a lot. Okay. He's, he's like, there is nobody who would appreciate these more than you and me.
Which tells you that, first off, we're cultivating the identity that we have been trying to cultivate out there.
I really like the brand. And also, there's no more perfect time for, I've got beer everywhere. There's no more perfect time for us to be drinking these than coming off of that Apple Cup.
Absolutely.
Oh, go Dogs.
Dominating performance by the Huskies.
Well, a toast to Tyler.
Yeah, absolutely. Should we toast to another loyal listener?
Oh.
Well, actually, I guess maybe not. But so last week, you'll recall, we invited the listener.
Aged to perfection.
Oh, there you go. Can you detect notes of the 2016 vintage?
I don't know if it's very good. You should try some and see what you think.
Yeah, it's a little flat. A little flat at this point. But you know what? It still tastes like happy holidays and Husky domination.
I'm going to see how far I can go here because this might be kind of gross.
There might be a side beer kind of situation. So last week we invited the listener to submit your top five Thanksgiving food items after we did so on our
perfect
podcast.
Sorry. It's perfect.
Okay.
I had a bigger sip.
Good. On our podcast with Nate Duncan, using the hashtag Peltoncast top five, many of you did so. And we have gone through and randomly selected a winner for this contest to win a Peltoncast hat. And that winner is, in fact, Emily Jeremiah at MNeil on Twitter, who came through this top five, her first tweet since February 2016.
Wow. Also aged to perfection.
Yes. Her Twitter account undoubtedly was. And I like that there was a reply on this. This is a perfect return to Twitter.
Oh, I agree with that person who replied that. What was her top five?
Her top five, unorthodox, I would say.
Okay.
Unconventional. Number one, mashed potatoes.
Okay.
Number two, sausage stuffing. Number three, cinnamon applesauce.
Interesting. Cinnamon applesauce.
I think this came up on last week's, wait for it, House of Carbs, about how in many ways, like, applesauce is more appropriate than, or was that when us talking with Nate Duncan? I'm misremembering it.
Do you confuse us talking and House of Carbs?
I think I do now.
Oh, do you think you're on House of Carbs when we talk to Nate Duncan? It's like some fantasies playing out for you.
I'm literally blushing now. This is quite embarrassing.
I don't think that was with Nate Duncan that we talked about.
So the point out that it was actually a more authentic, like, a better seasonal thing than, I don't know, corn, I think was maybe their alternative that they were throwing out there.
Bullshit. Come on.
Or maybe cranberries.
Get out of here with corn.
All right, anyways, number four, Brussels sprouts.
Interesting.
I've not thought, considered, I can't say I'm a fan of Brussels sprouts, but I had not considered them as a Thanksgiving. I guess they may have been in the House of Carbs now that I mentioned it. And then number five, sweet potato casserole, which was not a thing that I knew existed until we did this competition.
What is sweet potato casserole? Can you break that down for me?
All right, let me go see if I can find loyal listener Mike Bates, Third Pelton brother Mike Bates, I should say, his explanation of it. To
your distinction between Third Pelton brothers and loyal listeners is very extreme. Everybody's a Third Pelton brother. And
to me, Third Pelton brothers are people who have actually appeared on the show.
You have to appear on the podcast.
Yeah, that's how you become a Third Pelton brother.
Okay.
Is by appearing on the podcast.
Okay, so tell us about sweet potato casserole.
Well, hold on. I have to pull up his tweet here. And this is taking a surprisingly long time to find him on Twitter. I wish to hear more. So I said, I wish to hear more about sweet potato casserole. And he said, in the Midwest, we do casserole everything for Thanksgiving, which is well known. So there's many options. And said the closest to what they eat was a Food Network recipe that it's got a crunchy pecan topping on there and mashed sweet potatoes. And it does sound quite delicious. So there you go.
Well, congrats to Emily.
Now, I think I'm going to go out on a limb here. I think we can assume that Emily is related to loyal listener Mike Jeremiah.
Okay.
Who is a member of the Peltoncast Fantasy League.
Okay.
And who I met last weekend at the PK80 Invitational Tournament.
Really?
In Portland, where he lives.
Really? Has he beaten me in fantasy football?
He's in your league.
Cross league beat me in fantasy football, probably.
Yeah, so I think somehow that checks out. Your fantasy genius moniker has taken a beating this year.
Yes.
It's safe to say.
So at the end of the season, I want to hear about PK80 for a second, but I want to talk about some podcasts that are coming up. It's like how SNL previews the episodes that are coming with the post-it notes with the host and the musical guest.
Yes.
So imagine that this is SZA. I wanted to mention at some point I want to do top five worst fantasy decisions that I've made this year. Once the fantasy season is over, because I've made way more than five bad fantasy decisions, but I want to highlight the top five worst ones.
Okay.
But also we have two of my favorite podcasts of the entire year coming. Kind of three, even.
I would say, what's the third?
Well, the third is revisiting, which we did with Danny Kelly at the live show, revisiting our NFL over-unders, because I like seeing how wrong we were.
Yeah, I was considering, we already have recorded with Sheil, obviously. He mentioned something about his prediction for the Eagles season that made me want to go and revisit what we predicted for the Eagles season, but I have not done so. We'll keep that fresh for when we go through everyone.
But two of my favorite podcasts every year of the 2-3 years that we've done them. Number one, Peltoncast, Year in Music.
Always a great time.
That's going to be coming up in the next 2 weeks or so. We are going to go through the Pitchfork top 10 songs of the year and then rank our own top 10 songs of the year.
So I have been exhaustively preparing for this. I've listened through to you put together a playlist of your top songs of 2017. Is that out there? Have we tweeted that?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, we'll have to tweet that as kind of a preview.
I want to wait until it's refined. I want to unveil that with the podcast Here in Music.
All right. You'll have to wait, just like for presents on Christmas Day. You'll have to wait for this playlist. But I have been listening through that multiple times, have been, you know, breaking down the like contenders for my top 10. And I feel like I'm in a pretty good place right now.
You're basically like the Charlie meme of him looking at all the things on the wall.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's me. That's fair. But I'm excited.
And then easily my favorite podcast of the year,
which is our year in Seattle Sports Year in Review and upcoming year preview, where we make our bold predictions for the upcoming year. I went back and reviewed my bold predictions last week in preparation for this podcast. And let me tell you, some of them were spectacularly bad.
Too bold?
Not even necessarily too bold, just completely wrong.
Well, I just wanted to warn people to look out for those, because especially the year in review, I believe, is going to come somewhere around, maybe even after Christmas, before the new year. It's a complicated podcast time. People are traveling. I don't want anybody to miss out on that podcast, because it is easily our best of the year.
It is definitely one of the most fun because you just get to make fun of how bad our predictions are.
We'll run through the top 10 Seattle sports stories, make bold predictions, and then crown the Pelton Cast Seattle Sports Star of the Year.
I've been doing some thinking about that too. That's kind of an interesting call. It's not an obvious choice this year.
In the past, we used to just go back and forth between Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson.
It actually didn't happen as much like that because Marshawn was in there. Richard Sherman was in there. Last year, did we both do Coach Pete last year?
Well, mine. You remember I had a wild card pick.
But that wasn't your official pick.
Did I go with Coach Pete?
Yeah, I think so. Your wild card pick was not your official pick.
My wild card pick was Kevin Durant last year.
Yes.
I feel like I need to come up with an even wilder card this year.
I feel like mine is going to be kind of a wild card potentially. So we'll see. Again,
okay.
Stay tuned. But still listen to this podcast now.
Even I'm just so ready for that. Anyway, I just wanted to warn people because we're getting into the season. I'm getting excited.
Yeah, you still haven't done Pete Carroll. Pete Carroll's still out there.
Oh, great. This is not going to be Pete Carroll's year. He's like, if I run Eddie Lacy just one more time, maybe I'll get it.
You also never did Marshawn Lynch.
Still have a chance at that one, too. That one's just sitting out there.
Well, you know.
Seattle Sports Star of the Year for making sure that Marcus Peters wasn't ejected.
Wait, was ejected?
Was not ejected. He went out there and defended Marcus Peters.
Oh, okay.
And then he got ejected because of it.
Oh, right.
And that's
right.
Why he's the Seattle Sports Star of the Year.
Yeah. I thought it was because of his recent stint in the news. Anything else on this?
No.
Or should we actually do the actual podcast?
I'm just so excited.
I know, me too.
I want to record them right now.
This is also a weirdly light week in sports news, I would say. Starting with the fact that there's basically no arena update in the past week since we talked on last week's episode about the Key Arena renovation memorandum of understanding vote passing through to the full Seattle City Council that is scheduled for December 4th, which is a week from today as we record this. The one thing that's going to happen this week is that Jenny Durkin will take office as mayor, and we'll see if she has anything further to say on the arena debate above and beyond her stridently neutral comments during the campaign for mayor.
Aggressively neutral.
Yes. Overwhelmingly neutral. So we'll probably know a lot more this time next week, but at this point, not really much to report. Just kind of in a holding pattern.
Okay, what about Husky basketball? I mean, we do have one pretty big topic to discuss here.
We do. Recapping the Apple Cup?
Yes.
Yeah. Husky men's basketball was at home last weekend, taking on Seattle U and UC Davis, and both of those were nail biters, particularly the game against Seattle U, but Huskies ultimately victorious in both of those games, avoided the kind of bad misstep at home they've had in past seasons, although still some opportunities for that one coming up on the schedule. Finally saw some regression, and finally made regression to the mean work for them from three-point range in terms of opponent three-point shooting, because UC Davis went 5 of 21 from three-point range. In less exciting news, both Seattle U and UC Davis shot about 60% on two-pointers against the Huskies, who continue to have a very hard time defending inside. Looked like they went to more man against UC Davis. I was kind of half-watching this because I was at the PK80, actually.
No, we didn't talk about that.
For both of these games. We can get to that here in the college basketball section.
Okay.
Also, some news last week. Backup point guard freshman Michael Carter III suffered a broken hand and is out 6 to 8 weeks. Without him, really saw Mike Hopkins tighten up the rotation. Most notably, David Crisp, without a backup point guard, played a combined 77 of a possible 80 minutes in these two games at point guard. Then also, Devonir DeRusso left the team, will stay at UW as a student for the remainder of the year before transferring. Can't say this is surprising to anyone after playing a little bit early in his freshman season and looking unprepared for that level of competition. DeRusso hasn't really played much since then. Had only played in the exhibition game this year, so he doesn't burn in a year of eligibility by transferring. So that's the good news about this. Does leave the Huskies even thinner in the middle than they already were, which is really, really quite thin, with only Sam Timmons as a true center on the roster. Obviously, Noah Dickerson plays a lot there. And then Hamir Wright, who didn't play much over the weekend, is also an option at center. But that is the news from the Huskies. This weekend, they will again be, or this week rather, they will again be facing some rather weak competition. On Tuesday, it's number 302 in the Ken Pomeroy rankings, Kennesaw State coming to town. Kennesaw State, which is coached by former BC coach Al Skinner, is 0-5 against D1 opponents. And also, we should have Baby Fantasy Genius on to do what Kennesaw State's nickname is, because I haven't the slightest
clue. He definitely knows.
And I even looked at their page on kenpom.com earlier today and still have failed to retain that information.
Do you want me to wake him up? He would be very, I'd be like, Kennesaw State.
He'd be right on top of it. Maybe just ask him while he's sleeping. He could just they are, in fact, the Owls, apparently.
Kennesaw, he nailed Lipscomb earlier.
Yeah, of course he did.
He even knew it was bisons, plural, and not bison.
And then on Sunday, the Huskies take you on number 260 in the Ken Pomeroy rankings, Nebraska Omaha, which are the Mavericks. And they are 0-7 so far this year. So if the Huskies lose, you know, again, if the Huskies lose either of these games, very, very bad sign. But they probably will not.
There are some positives to take away from the beginning of this Husky season, though. I mean, really quite a few positives, all things considered. They don't have an embarrassing loss so far. The two losses at MSG against Providence, whatever, those are fine losses. They played well against Providence. Virginia Tech is a much better team. You know, the Huskies are not at that point right now.
A team that shot 50 of 22.
And the Huskies are traveling across country, so they don't have a bad loss. And Jalen Noel has kind of emerged as kind of the alpha offensive player on this team.
I don't know if I'd necessarily say that. Noah Dickerson is still the go-to guy most of the game. What Jalen Noel has emerged is cue the TNT music, the closer.
Is that a TV show on TNT?
I think it was at some point. I'm pretty sure about that.
He's emerged as Franklin and Bash.
Oh, man, imagine if the Huskies had guys named Franklin and Bash. How exciting would that be?
Someday that's going to happen on a team, and you're going to break Twitter.
Oh, yeah. Down the stretch, he has been just outstanding in these games, and particularly at the free throw line, where the Huskies, a big reason they've been able to pull out these victories is they just make all their free throws at the end of games, and it turns out that's kind of like a cheat code.
Yeah, what the hell? Against Seattle U, make 6 consecutive free throws. That doesn't happen. The Huskies do not have players who can hit free throws down the stretch. I don't remember the last time they had a player who could consistently do that, or a team that felt like they could do that. It's amazing.
I mean, I think they've had some players who could consistently do that. There's this guy, Isaiah Thomas.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah. I mean, probably Abdul Gaddy was pretty good at it when he was at the free throw line, or Terrence Ross or CJ Wilcox. I don't know. It's just the ones that were missed that stick out.
There are a lot of notable misses. It was impressive by Jalen Noel.
No, I'm not discounting what he's doing. He's been outstanding in that role. So
I think all things considered, through a couple of weeks, we have to be feeling pretty positive about the Mike Hopkins era so far.
Yeah, it's,
except they have no idea what they're doing on defense.
Yeah, and that's disconcerting. The weird thing, by the way, the Pac-12 looks bad.
Yeah, welcome to the Pac-12.
I don't know if you saw the Arizona.
Don't they look bad every year? Don't we say this in non-conference every single season about the Pac-12?
Not every season, a lot of seasons. Do you see that Arizona went 0-3 in the tournament? I believe they were playing in the tournament in the Bahamas. I forget what they call that now.
The Battle for Atlantis.
That sounds right. They went 0-3 after coming in as the number 2 team in the country. So that escalated quickly. Stanford was one of the two teams that went 0-3 in the PK80, losing to Portland State in their finale.
Oh my God.
But the team carrying the flag for the Pac-12, the one team out there beating expectations, the Cougs.
They're saying they're a basketball school after this weekend.
They 100% are, who won the Wooden Legacy tournament, upsetting St. Mary's, ranked St. Mary's, and then beating San Diego State in the final. So a very impressive kudos to the Cougs, who are off to a 6-0 start this year.
So you were down at the PK80 tournament kind of on and off this weekend. Literally an assortment of all of the best teams from throughout the country, right? Duke, North Carolina, Florida, and Michigan State, all top 10 teams.
Yeah, I mean, not all the best teams in the country, but a hefty percentage of them. I was looking at this. Ken Pom has their fan match score that says how good a game is based on the quality of the two teams and how evenly matched they are. And two of the best three games in the season so far were in the final.
The two finals.
On Sunday night. Those being Michigan State against North Carolina and Florida against Duke. And then the other game that was in there was the Champions Classic. Both of those games were also similarly highly rated. So it was a really awesome opportunity to have this in the Pacific Northwest and to be able to go down on both Friday and Sunday And really, the action, you know, the North Carolina-Michigan State final was kind of disappointing because the Tar Heels had their lowest shooting percentage ever in a game, which...
In the history of North Carolina?
It's been a long time. Wow. So that's, like, that says
something. It's kind of amazing that you saw that. It's kind
of amazing. That's history right there. And I got to see Roy Williams talk about how terribly he coached and how terribly they played before he walked out and bumped me on his way into the hallway. So,
he bumped you?
Yeah, I mean, that was quite... That's an opportunity. Like, I feel very lucky that now... Between the NCAA tournament in Seattle and Portland and some other one-off games now, I've seen like the vast majority of the great coaches of this era.
And they've all bumped into you.
Every single one. So Coach K, Roy Williams, Tom Izzo, notably in this tournament. Rick Pitino was in the NCAA tournament in Seattle a couple years ago.
You saw Lorenzo Romar many times.
Many times. The Judd Calipari brought Kentucky into Portland a few years ago to play a game for Terrence Jones when he was there. So that's a pretty cool thing. But also the action was terrific. There were two overtime games on the Friday and the semifinals. Duke and Texas, big comeback by Duke to win and get to the finals. And then Florida and Gonzaga played an epic double overtime game that really neither team deserved to lose before Florida finally pulled that one out, which is kind of too bad because Gonzaga, like as good as game as Florida and Duke was, and that was another terrific game, another Duke comeback to win late. The atmosphere, if it had been Gonzaga fans and Duke fans in there for the final, would have just been insane because there were a lot of Gonzaga fans there, as you might imagine.
I don't know what I would have done if Gonzaga and Duke were playing each other.
Yeah, you would have. I mean, they played each other in the, was that the Elite Eight a few years ago or the Sweet 16? I know it was in a regional final somewhere along the way in Houston.
I had to do a lot of soul searching when that happened.
That was after they won in their sub-regional in Seattle that year. Yeah. I think one of my big takeaways from the weekend is that Duke has become North Carolina.
Really?
So North Carolina, especially...
This is kind of a hot take, right?
No. I don't know if it is, but I hope it's not a really obvious observation, at least. So like during Jordan's heyday, kids everywhere loved Carolina. Like we were so diehard Carolina fans vis-a-vis Duke when we were growing up. And
you're telling me that is flipped?
Just so many more Duke fans there than Carolina fans.
That doesn't mean that young people prefer Duke.
I think they do. I think the Coach K coaching the Olympic team has been a big factor.
Huh.
But then the other thing is, so like Duke, we think of when we're growing up, like, oh, they have all these guys who are good in college, like four-year players. They're not going to do anything in the NBA.
White guys.
Huge disappointments. Not always, but yes. And then Carolina had all the NBA prospects who went out early. And now Duke's got all the one-and-done guys. They've got Marvin Bagley. And Carolina like has maybe no guys who are going to get drafted in the first round at all on this year's team.
Really?
And like their best player so far has been Luke May, who's this like 6'8 power forward who really has no NBA potential to speak of and got pretty thoroughly shut down by Michigan State in the final, but like is a great college player.
What about last year on North Carolina? Did they have NBA players?
I mean, they had Tony Bradley, most notably, who was a first-round pick by the Jazz.
I've actually heard some other guys
who have been drafted.
I was trying to think, like, the last few years. I mean, you know, like, as far as notable NBA players.
Duke has
Kyrie, right?
Yes.
Who just barely went to Duke.
I mean, I guess they had three first-round picks off the championship team that year. Tyus Jones, Justice Winslow, and Jahlil Okafor. Those guys have not panned out super well.
But as far as like,
NBA.
You know, like in the 90s, we had like Anton Jameson and Jerry Stackhouse.
Well, that's because all those guys go to Kentucky now.
Okay. What you mean is Kentucky is the new North Carolina. I understand. I get it. Because you're really not factoring in how Duke of a player Grayson Allen is.
That's true. I'm not disputing that.
He's the Grayson most Allen classic Duke player of all time.
Essentially Duke. By the way, shout out to JJ Redick for getting his podcast on the Ringer Network. I don't know if this is hurting our chances of having him on the Pelton cast. No.
Third Pelton brother, JJ?
Oh, man.
He'll come on.
All right, so I think that's pretty much it as far as takeaways from the PK80 Invitational. The UW women were in a tournament over the weekend in the South Point Shootout in Las Vegas where they beat Creighton 67-64 and then lost to number 2 Texas by 24 points.
Okay.
So that was a tough matchup for this young UW team, which visits Idaho and hosts Portland this weekend. Also, how about UW volleyball? Chelected is the number 8 overall seed in the NCAA tournament, which starts this weekend. So the way they do it in the volleyball tournament is they like list out the seeds. Like essentially they're the last number 2 seed
mm-hmm.
and they'd
give the full S curve.
Yes. Although, but they only give it for the top 16 teams. And then after that, they don't list any seeds whatsoever, which is kind of weird. This weekend, the Huskies will host the sub-regional where they'll face LIU Brooklyn in the opening round. And the winner of that faces the winner of Hawaii and Illinois. Basically, every year, I think Hawaii plays in UW's sub-regional, it seems like. So they've played each other a lot. And then if the Huskies advance, they would go to the regional that is being hosted by the number one overall seed, Penn State.
Mm.
So good luck to the UW volleyball team.
Anything to mention about the Sounders? I know we're kind of gearing toward, we talked last week about their big victory on the road in Houston, but looking forward to this next match where it feels like we'd say there's a 90%+ chance of them advancing to the MLS Cup final.
97% according to Soccer Power Index. They the only scenario is, you know, they have to lose by 2 goals, and it has to be, if it's just 2-0, that would result in extra time. Houston would have to score at least 3 goals and win by 2 goals to win outright. So that's going to be difficult for them to do. I think it's fair to say. I think the one important bit of news is that Jordan Morris was back in training on Friday. So it looks like there is a real chance that he could get back to on the pitch for the first time in a couple months for this second leg. So we talked about whether it made sense to, you know, how it made sense to use him in this match. But I think ideally, if you can bring him on as a sub in a situation where it's not looking like extra time is a possibility, then that would basically allow you to get him acclimated, and hopefully you're preparing him for what would be the MLS Cup.
How scared are you going to be if Houston scores a goal first?
Kind of scared. I mean, still it's in a position where, you know, next goal is crucial, and you'd give the Sounders the advantage of in that regard. I mean, they haven't lost a lot of games at home recently.
Yes.
In the Brian Schmetzer era. And to do so by 2 goals would be pretty stunning.
It's going to be interesting to watch, though, seeing Houston out there just trying to score goals aggressively. It's going to be a fun game to watch.
Which is kind of what they're built to do. I mean, you know, they'll probably... They had to shift out of this in the last match because of the fact that they had a red card early, but they'll go, you know, go with a 4-3-3. You'll have several attacking players out there. They have several players capable of scoring goals. And the one thing that does particularly concern me is the fact that you won't have Roman Torres at center back due to his yellow card accumulation. So unclear whether the Sounders will go with Tony Alfaro, the younger player, in kind of a straight swap, or whether they might move Gustav Svensson back to center back, where he has not been nearly as effective as playing defensive midfielder and is not as comfortable playing. So hopefully it does not come to that, I would say. But you know, definitely one of the biggest matches in Sounders history, as we talked about last week, a chance to win hardware, you know, win a trophy at home for the first time since winning the U.S. Open Cup in Seattle many, many years ago. I think maybe 2010 was the last time they did that at home, 2010 or 2011. So it's been a while. You don't get this opportunity every day. All right. Well, speaking of winning hardware at home, the Apple Cup continued to stay with the University of Washington for the fourth consecutive year throughout the Chris Peterson era as they, is it fifth consecutive year or fourth consecutive? I guess fifth consecutive. Yeah. Throughout the Chris Peterson era, plus the last year of Sark's tenure, as they really dominated the Cougs 41-14 in a game that was not really that close, I would say. Wazoo scoring twice in the fourth quarter against a prevent defense after going down 34-0 in this game.
Whoa! Oh, my God. I mean, we have to talk about this. So going into this game, the atmosphere was insane. I mean, I've been going to Husky games basically every single game for 10 years, right?
More than that, even.
For 11 years, I guess.
Yeah.
Basically every single home game for 11 years. This was by far the biggest crowd I have ever seen in the E1 parking lot.
I mean, you couldn't even move around. It was that difficult. And Cougs everywhere. It felt like they outnumbered
Huskies. So many Cougs. Going into the game, I mean, you look around, and obviously there were more Husky fans there than there were Cougar fans. There were a lot of Cougs there. They felt like this was a game they could win.
Well, of course. And they felt we were going to celebrate going to the Pac-12 championship on Husky Stadium.
And I said to you before the game, there are going to be a lot of disappointed Cougar fans after this one. And there were. There weren't actually that many after because they all left at halftime.
That's what I was going to say. They were no longer in the stands. They just weren't there anymore. Which
they disappeared. There was a rapture of Cougar fans that happened. Well,
given the weather conditions, was probably the right move on their part because it wasn't that fun to stay the entire game as I did. But I stuck it out because...
Judging by first-hand experience, Coug fans got very drunk. They drank their sorrows.
I don't know. Some Husky fans got very drunk as well in our first-hand experience.
It's out of celebration. But they went into this game thinking that their ranking mattered. They didn't listen to the PelotonCast preview and realized that they're bad at offense. We could see it. And Wazoo, somehow you look at it statistically and you're like, okay, Luke Falk threw for, what, exactly how many yards?
289, I believe.
369 yards. Oh. You can see how people would be confused by this Wazoo team, what they are.
Right.
But they're bad at offense, and this Husky defense exposed them in every way. Luke Falk with three picks plus the fumble, they were all over him. I mean, Vita Vea played the game of his life. Vita Vea is, I think, made himself game.
Oh, absolutely.
He was already going to be a high draft pick, but I feel like he's a first-round draft pick.
I mean, we'll see, but it was a dominant performance. So basically what the Huskies did most of this game was dropped eight players into coverage, played a lot of zone, and then rushed with just the three down linemen that they have, or I guess two down linemen and then one rush end. And Vita Vea, still 3-on-5, was able to get to the quarterback time and time again.
Unstoppable.
In a way that, on the other side, you know, the Huskies were able to completely take Hercules Mata'afa, Wazoo's playmaking defensive tackle, undersized defensive tackle, completely out of the game and make him a non-back.
Literally.
Yes, he...
Until he was taken completely out of the game by being ejected.
Yes, that did happen.
And now, is he going to be suspended for part of their bowl game? What's the deal with that?
I think that was in the second half, so yes, I think so.
Oh, my God.
That is pretty devastating. I mean, it is a really weird box score when you look at it, because, as you mentioned, Falk throws for 369 yards. Jake Browning threw for 93 yards in this game. And yet, still has a QBR three times as good as Luke Falk's because of the fact that he didn't turn the ball over, and he was fine.
These last two games, it feels like the Husky offense, they've kind of figured it out with just having Jake hand the ball off.
I mean, I don't know that you can do that against every opponent, but...
Maybe it was Oregon where Jake did that, right?
There was a lot of that against Oregon.
But they run the ball 45 times for 328 yards. Miles Gaskin. Husky legend Miles Gaskin. Oh, my God.
Closing in on becoming the all-time leading rusher in program history. 25 carries for 192 yards, 7.7 a pop, and four touchdowns. And then, you know, I think one of the big takeaways, so LaVon Coleman goes out early in this game, which was sad to see on his senior day. But the positive benefit of that is it meant that the Huskies were kind of forced to use Savon Ahmed as like just a tailback. And instead of, you know, constantly using him on the fly sweeps and end arounds and as a receiver. So it turns out he's pretty good at that. Like, you just line him up and run him. He's pretty good at that and has 9 carries for 82 yards in this game. So I want to see more of that and look forward to seeing more of that in the future.
I mean, we have to wait a long time for the games next year, but they are going to be, Savon Ahmed is going to be a focus of this offense.
One would think, yeah.
I mean, he goes into next year where you're expecting him to be one of the most explosive players in the Pac-12. But Wazoo couldn't run the ball, couldn't pass the ball. I mean, they ran the ball.
Never tried to run the ball. They only
five carries for 11 yards.
It's, I mean.
For Jamal Morrow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, most of their runs were Luke Falk sacks, which is why they ended up with minus 24 yards rushing.
There we go. Minus 24 yards rushing. Oh, man.
Second time this year the Huskies have held an opponent to negative rushing, which again is due to ridiculous stat keeping by the NCAA to consider sacks as rushing yards, but still, like, it echoes the tradition of, you know, thinking of those like 91 teams and the Rose Bowl teams and the Don James era in the early 90s who did that on a regular basis because of the fact that they accumulated so many sacks. So Vita Vea with a Steve Entman-esque performance, I would say.
I mean, it was just a great game all around, everything about it. Our mom was asking me earlier, wouldn't I have preferred a closer game? And we talked about this last week, right? During my grievance.
We sure did.
And I did not want a closer game in this one. Against those Wazoo fans, I wanted them out of the building.
Exactly.
And that's what happened. The Huskies came out, hit them right away, and they got the ball, hit them with the touchdown, running the ball, and it was over from that point forward. Luke Falk could not do anything. Luke Falk is not even necessarily a competent college quarterback.
I mean, I don't think it's all on Luke Falk. I think...
You also have to blame the scheme.
Yeah. I mean, clearly the Huskies know what they're doing against this.
But it feels so good to completely own this rivalry.
It does.
Can I go into my grievance, though?
Well, first I want to just say one thing of note that came out of this game from a Husky standpoint. I think we mentioned Coleman going out early in this game. Also Dante Pettis, which was a shame to see on his senior night as well. But I think one of the key takeaways from this game, and it's going to sound funny about a guy who had two catches, but Ty Jones with a breakthrough performance, seeing more action after Dante Pettis went down, is basically like the only receiver the Huskies have had at that point with any size and you know, just kind of physical ability. And so he was the only receiver on the team with multiple catches, and then also came up with a late onside kick, which was nice.
They're going to have some work to do at wide receiver over the offseason.
They sure are.
I know that that's been a focus for Coach Pete in a couple of offseasons, but they're going to have to figure out exactly what that rotation is going to be and sort wide receiver out. Who are some of the seniors that are going, by the way? Can we do a quick tribute to the Husky seniors that this was their last home game?
Yeah, we can do that. I'm going to have to look up a list of them to do this. So this is the list on the roster. I'll try to go from memory about who actually walked as part of Senior Day festivities. Keyshawn Bieria.
Ugh.
He will definitely be missed. Has been, you know, probably the Huskies' most consistent inside linebacker this year with Azeem Victor. His struggles. And Ben Burkervin's been terrific too, but Bieria most consistent. Then the aforementioned Pettis, Coleman, Ezekiel Turner at safety and a key player on special teams. Connor O'Brien, who has been part of the rotation at rush end. Sean Constantine, never really broke through as a middle linebacker. I think had some injuries that limited him. Azeem Victor did not go through Senior Day festivities, obviously, because he's suspended, but is there. Walk-on senior tailback Ralph Kinney, who got some carries late in this game after Mike Leach kept calling timeouts. Tristan Vizcano.
Oh, Tristan.
Who has turned
things
around.
Good for you, Tristan. Good for you.
This season.
We believed in you the entire time.
Andrew Kirkland, who was in the rotation at left tackle after the Trey Adams injury. Coleman Shelton, also on the offensive line, a starter. Tight end David Ajimu. Some walk-ons. Tight end Will Disley.
Thrill.
And I think that's it, at least that they have listed on the roster. I can't remember anyone else off the top of my head.
So kind of amazing that, given what this team has accomplished over the last two seasons, that the primary players that they're losing are LaVon Coleman, ostensibly a backup running back, Dante Pettis, an amazing playmaking wide receiver, but who, as a receiver, had a little bit of a disappointing season.
Yeah.
And Keyshawn Bieria and Coleman Shelton.
I mean, then some rotation guys, certainly. Some key depth. But yeah, I mean, what they're going to lose probably from a talent standpoint is probably going to be more the underclassmen who go to the NFL. So that's going to be the concern.
We'll wait and see on that.
Yeah, we'll continue to track that. All right, you wanted to get to your grievance.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
This is a New Year's 16.
This is my grievance too.
Is it really?
Yeah, of course.
Keeping the Huskies out of a New Year's 6 bowl is absurd. I mean, first off, there should be a much larger playoff and the Huskies should be in it. But this is a team that is almost, if not, they're close to as good as the team that participated in the College Football Playoff last year. Currently number 7 in FPI, Football Outsiders, FEI is not updated as of this moment. Point differential, number 9 in the country. They belong with these teams that top tier. Two losses, both road games, one of which was to a Stanford team that just destroyed Notre Dame. They may still get in. Look, I'm not saying that they won't, but this is a team.
It seems pretty clear they won't get in.
Why?
Just based on who various bowls are obligated to select and who they likely will select. And it seems exceedingly unlikely that the Huskies will get in the New Year's 6.
This team playing in one of the Pac-12 second-tier bowls, the Alamo Bowl or the Holiday Bowl or whatever these bowls are, the Sun Bowl.
I mean, I don't think there's any chance of them going to the Sun Bowl. It'll
be the
Alamo
Fight Hunger Bowl. But playing in that bowl is a shame for this team being so good to not be playing at this elite level.
Yeah. No, but I 100% agree. All the math checks out there. 8th in the Sagarin predictor. Like, this is, there is not a compelling argument that this is not one of the 10 best teams in the country.
Yes.
You can debate where among the top 10 they rank, but they are definitely one of the 10 best. And is one of the 10 best, you should be playing in a New Year's 6 bowl. But because of the fact that they are not as marquee a name, and because of the fact that they ended up, you know, they're going to finish ostensibly third in the Pac-12 by virtue of not winning their division, based on the tiebreaker, that's going to keep them out in all likelihood. And yeah, it's not great, but there are worse grievances.
Not really. I mean, there are worse grievances, but this is a team that is the season that they have had is not going to be served by the bowl that they play in.
I agree with that. And what you often see in these situations, and it'll be interesting to see if Coach Pete can combat this, is that those teams tend to underperform in their bowl game when they're going against a lesser foe.
I have confidence in Coach Pete.
For example, like when Nebraska was in the Holiday Bowl and lost to the Huskies in Jake Locker's final game. That's a great example.
I mean, this is really an argument for why they should be, maybe they wouldn't make it into an 8-team playoff, but this is why there should be a 16-team playoff, because then you have something to play for. And this team could make some noise in a big playoff.
Oh, it's an argument why you should go back to the like ancient bowls.
No, bowl games are stupid.
Of the 80s, where they didn't have as many automatic tie-ins.
Bowl games are
and you had more flexibility
worst.
To set, select teams based on how good they were.
I hate bowl games.
You're wrong.
This is like the only issue where we're on the complete opposite sides of the issue.
There are a few.
I want like a 64-team college football playoff, and you want no playoff at all.
That's, you can't get any farther apart than that. It is undoubtedly the case.
But either way, this Husky team is good enough by every single measure, including wins and losses, including the eye test. There's really no measure that you can look at to say that they don't belong in one of these New Year's Six bowls.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talked in the past about their lack of a signature win. And by the way, we'll see what the college football playoff ranking has them. We're recording
this. That's what I'm saying. We may find out more. Look, they might believe, they believed in Wazoo way more than they should. That's in those college football playoff rankings. So maybe they see this as a signature win.
Doesn't control who gets selected. Like, other than, you know, the top four and then who from the group of five gets into the New Year's Six bowls. Other than that, it's just up to the bowls to select. The college football, in practice, virtually always it matches the college football playoff committee rankings.
But you know, Notre Dame's getting in there.
Well, obviously.
Notre Dame could lose 15 games and still get in. Yep. They could have lost two or three more games this year.
And that's one of the teams that is worse than UW by any measurable statistic and is still going to get in ahead of them. So I guess what I'm saying is Husky fans need to travel better.
I think Husky fans travel fine. Maybe more people should stop cheering for Notre Dame.
They don't travel that well to home games for one thing.
That's true.
All right, but speaking of some fans who do travel well, apparently dominated the stadium in San Francisco.
Love those Seahawks chants at the game.
Yeah, that's outstanding to hear. Let's get to our special guest, Sheil Kapadia, and talk about the Seahawks and the Eagles. Well, with the Philadelphia Eagles coming to town to play the Seahawks this Sunday, there was definitely no better person that we could have on to talk about both the Eagles and the Seahawks than the former Seahawks reporter for ESPN, who sadly left us at the start of this season, but for a good cause, to go back to his native Philadelphia and cover the Eagles for the new Athletic Philadelphia site. So we are thrilled to have with us Sheil Kapadia. Thanks for joining us.
You said a good cause. It made it sound like I was actually contributing to society in some positive way. So I appreciate that.
The Eagles are a pretty big part of society in Philadelphia, as I understand it.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's good. It makes me feel better about myself.
What's the mood in Philly about this team and the 10-1 start that has them atop the NFL standings?
They are hyped. I'd say they're probably as hyped as I've seen since the Terrell Owens year when they got to the Super Bowl and lost to the Patriots. I think that was the last time the city really felt like it had a, you know, every year, of course, they feel like they can get to the Super Bowl, but in a realistic way. This is the first time, I think, since then that they're really really feeling it. They had sort of a run, I think it was 2008, where they were like 8-8 or one game above 500, and then they got hot and made it to the NFC title game and lost. But this is the first time since 2004 where it's like this many games in a row where they really feel like they have a chance to win and dominate and lead the league and margin of victory, all those different types.
How many years were you in Seattle, Sheil? What was your first year covering the Seahawks?
2 years. I was there for 2 years.
Okay, so you weren't here for any Super Bowl seasons.
I was not. No, I joined after the loss to the Patriots. That August, I got there.
Good timing. What do you think the reaction from the fan base is like in Philadelphia to a very good NFL team in Philadelphia versus a fan base in Seattle?
You know, I got to Seattle at such a weird time. Like you mentioned, the team was so good. Everyone knew the superstar players, the culture, the coach, all those different types of things. So in my 2 years there, I felt like people were mostly positive and for good reason. I mean, the team has been to the divisional round for every year. Russell Wilson has been the quarterback. So, you know, I didn't really, I guess the second half of my first year there, 2015, they were really playing as well as anybody in the league. And, you know, I would say it wasn't, the level of hype probably wasn't as high just because they had been there, you know, 2 years in a row. And it was like the expectation was that they needed to get to the Super Bowl or the season would be a disappointment. This Eagles season probably feels more like what the Seahawks had in Russell Wilson's first or second year. You know, those are the best types of seasons for sports fans, is when the expectations might not be through the roof going into the year, and then the team kind of not comes out of nowhere, but you know what I mean, exceeds expectations right away. And, you know, you can go into it. You're not necessarily playing with house money, as they say, but it feels a little bit like.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be weird to say because the Seahawks did win a Super Bowl, but I still feel like it could never possibly be as exciting as Russell's rookie season.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those are the years, I think, in every sport where you have young players on the rise and you feel like you're building towards something. I think those are the most fun as a sports fan.
You obviously got to Philadelphia at kind of the perfect time, both with basketball and football. It feels like there's so much happening sports-wise in Philadelphia. But at the beginning of the year, there was, I believe, a podcast that Mike Lombardi did where he kind of called out Doug Peterson, called him a bad coach before the year. And as I understand, the city of Philadelphia took it quite personally.
Yeah, you understand correctly. He called Doug Peterson the least qualified coach he had ever seen in his 30 years in the NFL. Obviously, regardless of what you think of Peterson, there's some hyperbole there. I can't imagine that would really be the case if he went through every coach.
Yeah, Jim Zorn was a coach after being hired as an offensive coordinator.
Yeah, I think there's a pretty long list, but it was really funny. That was kind of right after I moved back, and there were a lot of questions about Doug Peterson. I had a lot of questions about Doug Peterson. I had no idea whether he was a good coach, a bad coach, or whatever, based on what he did last year. But as is the case, I think, with every fan base and every city, you know, you can rip your own. Like, for example, in Seattle, you know, I'm sure there are still the calls about Daryl Bevel that there were there when I was there. However, I'm sure if some national reporter wrote some hot take column and just ripped Daryl Bevel and said he was the worst offensive coordinator in the league, everyone would be like, wait, hold on a minute. We're allowed to criticize him. You're not allowed to criticize him. And I really think that's what happened with Doug Peterson. I think it was one of the best things that could have happened to him in terms of public perception, in terms of the way the fan base viewed him, all those different types of things, because all of a sudden, even the people who thought Mike Lombardi might have a point, you know, they were upset that this outsider was coming in and ripping their coach. And so everyone kind of rallied around him. It was a very strange phenomenon for sure.
I've always said this. If you want the media to say nice things about your team or a player, the key is you shouldn't say nice things about them. You should say mean things about them because you've got to react to that consensus.
Yeah, I totally agree.
How would you contrast covering, you know, Doug Peterson and this Eagles team to covering Pete Carroll, which obviously an interesting experience always with Pete as coach?
I think Pete, in terms of just covering the coach, is probably among the top three or four in the NFL. He's, you know, some you may describe him as strange or odd or fascinating or whatever. I found it really entertaining to cover him and learn about his philosophies and learn his vocabulary. Just, you know, I learned pretty soon that when he says a guy has a legit ankle, like, that guy may be dead in a week. So, you know, to learn the Pete Carroll vocabulary took a while. I probably still didn't master it after 2 years, but he's such a big personality. You know, he's been everywhere from New England to New York to LA to Seattle. He knows so many people. He's had so many different experiences. He's coached so many different guys. Just totally different that. And then covering Doug Peterson here, who was just an unknown in his second year, you know, from what I understand, he was not high on their list of guys they wanted to hire. They tried to hire a few other guys. That didn't work out. And then they settled on Doug Peterson. So he, you know, he's more, you can leave his press conferences sometimes and not feel like you learn that much. Whereas with Pete Carroll, I felt like it was pretty different, where if you asked the right questions, you could gain some knowledge, but Peterson's in his second year in the NFL. I would say he's relatively honest and he's friendly enough and not combative. So he probably falls somewhere in the middle of the NFL coaching range.
What a cool opportunity for you to learn about Pete Carroll's vocabulary.
Yeah, absolutely. Very cool.
Before we get off coaches for a second, I wanted to ask you, one of our old foes from the Pac-12, who you covered in Philadelphia, we just learned this last weekend, is going to be returning to the Pac-12 as the head coach of UCLA, and that's Chip Kelly. What was your experience like covering him in Philadelphia?
I enjoyed covering him. He was another guy who, you know, very fascinating, a lot of buzz, had a lot of different philosophies and tried to think outside the box, all those different types of things. So that was really fun. Covering him and kind of everything you wrote about Chip Kelly, people wanted to read, whether it was about his offense, the tempo of practices, who influenced him, all those different types of things. So I really enjoyed covering him. I'm curious to see how he does at UCLA because, you know, the tempo and all those different types of things that he did, I feel like a lot of college programs are now doing that. I feel like a lot of high school programs are even doing that. So I think he needs to have a plan B. I don't think he had a plan B in the NFL, and that's what ultimately cost him. And that, along with sort of building relationships with players and other people in the building, I think those were his definite weaknesses. So I think football is a lot more interesting when he's coaching. So I'm curious to see how he does out there.
All right, so going back to the Eagles, they did rate quite well in Football Outsiders DVOA last season. We all recall there was the famous DVOA Bowl 2 when the Seahawks beat the Eagles midway through last season before both teams kind of fell off, the Seahawks after the Earl Thomas injury. Did you see this coming? Did anyone see this coming, even in the building, that they would make this kind of leap in Doug Peterson and Carson Wentz's second year?
No, I don't think so at all. You know, I had him at 8. Some people may have been a little more optimistic. I think the most optimistic people probably had him at maybe 10-6, 11-5, feeling like there wasn't an obvious other option in the NFC East. And then just that they surrounded Carson Wentz with a lot better weapons this year by adding Alshon Jeffrey. Nelson Aguilar is a lot better than he was last year. Zach Ertz is playing the best football of his career. And then Lane Johnson, the right tackle, had the 10-game suspension last year. He's been playing at a definite Pro Bowl level this year and has made a difference. But no, to answer your question, you know, I picked him at 8-8, and I thought if Wentz makes a bigger leap than I'm anticipating, they can get to 10-6. If he doesn't, you know, I thought the floor was pretty low, to be quite honest. I thought if Doug Peterson is not a good coach, some of these moves that they made in terms of the run game don't pan out, I thought that they could be 6-10 as well. So I don't think a lot of people saw this coming.
All right, so, you know, you mentioned the improvement in terms of the weapons around Carson Wentz. How do you sort of separate out his development from that upgrade of the players around him? How different is he as a quarterback from the one that we saw come into Seattle and go 23 of 45 last year for 218 yards and 2 interceptions?
He's definitely different. He has taken a big leap in many ways. There were some things mechanically with his accuracy and his arm motion and those different types of things that they worked on a lot in the offseason, and I think those have really paid off. And then with the weapons, the big thing is throwing the ball downfield. You know, they were a lot of dink and dunk last year, one, because they didn't have a lot of weapons, and two, because the offensive line wasn't as good as they thought it could be, and so they wanted to protect him and not have him develop some of those bad habits. So he's throwing the ball downfield a lot more this year, and I think the big thing is he's doing a lot at the line of scrimmage. You know, it's not like Peyton Manning, but it's they have a lot of situations where they let maybe give him two plays. They call it a take it system, where they'll give him two plays. He'll look at the coverage before the snap, and then he will ultimately choose the play. Or there are other times where he just totally calling audibles, and they've got those run pass options, which obviously the Seahawks use, a lot of teams around the league use. So decision making, knowing what he's seeing before the snap in terms of coverages, going through his progressions, all those different types of things. He's really made a pretty big leap in his second
season. Yeah, I've been really impressed with Carson Wentz. It was almost like his completion percentage, which sits around 60%, it's a little bit low for the elite quarterbacks in the league, and it's similar to what he had last year, but the yards per completion in particular are going way up this year. And the Eagles offense kind of feels like, to me, after looking at it statistically, it looks like a lot of pounding the ball and then throwing the ball downfield, and they've been really successful at those deep passes this year.
Yeah, absolutely. It's they've gotten leads early in almost every game, which that's another thing, just comparing the Eagles philosophy to the Seahawks, it's very different. You know, Doug Peterson came up under Andy, came up under Mike Holmgren, who you guys are obviously familiar with, and the thought was build a lead early with the pass, you know, throw the ball early if you need to, build a lead, and then in the second half, kind of pound away with the run game, make sure you have an efficient run game, force the opponent, throw the ball where you can really rush the passer. That's the philosophy that this team is built around, whereas, you know, Pete Carroll, it's always about the finish, and you're never out of it, and kind of keep it close, and in the fourth quarter, we'll find a way to win, and, you know, both have obviously been successful, both philosophies, but there is a difference there, and the run game to me has been maybe the biggest surprise on the team. I didn't really understand the move they made at running back in the offseason. They signed LeGarrette Blount, who anyone looking at it analytically, a 30-year-old running back coming off a career high in carries where he wasn't even that great last year. I think average 0.9 yards per carry. It seemed like there was no way that was going to work. And I've just been totally wrong on that. He has been really, really good. Fun to watch, good in the open field, breaking tackles, all those different types of things. And then obviously they made the Jay Ajayi trade, so he's in the mix, and they've got an undrafted rookie in Corey Clement. So the run scheme is very interesting. It's very diverse. They have a lot of different types of run plays. They've been smart into which ones they've called on any given week. The run blocking has been very good, and then the backs have made the most of their opportunities. So that to me is something I absolutely 100% did not see coming before the season, is them having this efficient of a run game.
What a strange concept. You sign a veteran running back as a free agent, and then he comes in and plays effectively.
It's the anti-Eddie Lacy. I don't know how they managed to turn LeGarrette Blount into a quality running back. It's amazing. But I was looking at it and seeing that it feels like the Eagles, almost all of their success running the ball is coming from pounding it up the middle, which seems so antithetical to me, from especially what we've seen in Seattle. But even in the NFL in general, and then also at the second level, where they're not a great team if you can bring them down at the first level, but if they get past that in the open field, Eagles running backs, including LeGarrette Blount, have been really good.
Yes, absolutely. You know, they have some different, it's not a purely zone blocking scheme. Like Seattle, they do run some zone blocking, but they'll run these trap plays like they, you know, 2 weeks ago against the Cowboys and David Irving, a really good defensive tackle. These trap plays where basically they'll have two guys pretend they're going to double team him, but they'll go right to the linebackers at the second level, and then the guard on the backside will kind of come from the side and just crush him. And, you know, they ran that over and over again against David Irving. I'm curious to see if that's a play they're going to try against Michael Bennett, a guy who can make so many plays behind the line of scrimmage. It's really built to take advantage of an aggressive defensive tackle. So they've been smart. Then against the Broncos, you know, they ran some read option and stuff like that against Von Miller, where it's not necessarily just their right tackle Lane Johnson blocking him. It's trying to keep him off balance with screens and read option and those different types of things. So that's just what I was saying before, that I think game plan perspective, I've just been very, very impressed at what they've done each week to kind of neutralize some of the best players on their opponents.
Yeah, you mentioned using read option with Carson Wentz, and he's been a threat on the ground. Do you see that being a factor in this game?
I think they'll mix it in, yeah. I think against aggressive defensive ends specifically, they do try to do that. They certainly don't do it as much as the Seahawks do it, and he doesn't. I mean, if he keeps it like once or twice in a game, that's a lot. There are games where he doesn't keep the ball at all, but certainly those shotgun zone runs with the run pass options are definitely a part of the offense. So yeah, you'll definitely see those on Sunday night.
Yeah, to me, the path to victory for the Seahawks here is, I think, stopping the run, especially if they're doing it on early downs, if Philadelphia is doing it on early downs, and getting Carson Wentz into longer situations. Granted, they've been able to pass the ball downfield pretty successfully, but you look at, he's a little bit prone for interceptions. The Eagles are a little bit prone for sacks. I think they sit about in the middle of the pack as far as sacks go. And it feels like this Seahawks defensive line, although they're not rated that high statistically, should have some success against this Eagles run game. And if they can do that and get the Eagles into third and seven, third and eight situations, force Carson Wentz to really make the plays himself, it feels like they might have a little bit more success in this one than other teams have had against the Eagles.
Yeah, the Eagles have been really good on third down and third and longs. I think they're in like the top three, but I do agree with you. I think there are some matchups up front. I know how good Bobby Wagner, KJ Wright are and how smart those guys are. So I think it's going to be a challenge for the Eagles to run the ball. And then I think on, you know, the Eagles offensive line is very good, but the weak link is the left tackle. I'll give you the full pronunciation here. Halapulavati Vaitai. I've been practicing that all
yes, nice.
I'm glad I could hear that with you here. Most of the people call him Big V. But we figured if we're covering this guy and interviewing him, we can at least learn how to pronounce his name. So we did do that. But he's a second-year player playing left tackle for Jason Peters. And he's done better than I thought he was going to do. However, like I said, he is the weak link. So whether it's Frank Clark over there, Michael Bennett, whether they're running some stunts with Sheldon Richardson, whether blitzing Bobby Wagner, I really think that's where Chris Richard will focus his pressure looks and their kind of game plan in terms of getting after Carson Wentz. I think they're really going to attack that. Left side is definitely weaker than the right side for the Eagles.
So a lot of Wentz MVP talk. Do you think that's a fair assessment of his value to the Eagles at this point?
I mean, I think it's like when Karl Malone got it over Michael Jordan, it would kind of have to be people are tired of Tom Brady getting it. I mean, if you look at it statistically, Brady probably has him beat in pretty much every category. And some of those numbers, you know, you mentioned completion percentage and yards per attempt is good, better than last year, but certainly not the lead. It's really been that the touchdown to interception ratio has certainly been very good. And that obviously bumps up the passer rating and some of those other things. Now, don't get me wrong. He's been outstanding. He is in many ways carrying them. He's very good in terms of improvisation, not at Russell Wilson's level, but you will see plays where you feel like a defensive lineman has him sacked and he makes some unbelievable spin move, gets out of it. He had a play last week where they were calling a screen pass and the defense brought an all-out blitz and he just had this crazy spin away from three defenders and picked up 16 yards with his leg. So he's been really good. I think he has room to improve. I think his ceiling is certainly to be one of the best one or two or three best quarterbacks in the NFL, certainly the kind of guy who can lead a team to a Super Bowl, carry a franchise on his back, all those different types of things. But in terms of MVP buzz this year, it's probably getting a little bit skewed by those touchdown to interception numbers. If you compare everything else, I think Brady definitely.
That Karl Malone to Michael Jordan comparison with Brady is going to be all over Philadelphia sports radio tomorrow.
Be the new Michael
Party. Yeah. You're still a secret agent for Seahawks, for the Seahawks Twitter, let's say. But we also want to talk about the Eagles defense going against the Seahawks offense.
I mean, it's been so solid across the board, Philly, defensively. Number six in pass defense DVOA before this week's game, which is not in there yet. And number five in rush defense DVOA. Is there a weakness that the Seahawks can attack here?
Well, it all starts with their defensive line. You know, their whole team philosophy was gamble on a to get a quarterback and then build and invest money into the offensive and defensive line. So they're pretty loaded up front. You know, Fletcher Cox and Brandon Graham played the left side. So against Jermaine Ifedi and Ethan Posick, that is...
Oh, no.
That is a huge advantage, obviously, in the Eagles' favor. And then they're very deep, too. You know, Derek Barnett, their first-round pick, has been playing really well. Before last game, he led hurries and has 4.5 sacks. They've got Chris Long, the veteran who can come in and play left defensive end. Tim Jernigan, the other defensive tackle, just got a nice contract. He's been playing really well, very good in terms of tackles for loss and penetration and against the run game. So that's where everything starts for them. Is there a weakness? Yeah, I would say, you know, their cornerbacks, I'm not 100% sold on them, and I think this is going to be a good matchup for them. Jalen Mills is a second-year guy. He was a seventh-round pick last year. Beginning of the season, he was giving up a lot of big plays. That hasn't happened recently, but he's a size and length guy. He's not a speed guy, so I'm curious to see if he can keep up with Paul Richardson or Tyler Lockett double moves, or if they just, you know, even just on go balls down the sideline. That's going to be interesting. And then Ronald Darby, the other corner, is a guy they traded for from the Buffalo Bills, and he's sort of the opposite. He is an elite athlete. However, he will gamble, and I think teams are going to start to try some double moves and ways to kind of get him to jump on underneath routes and then take advantage deep. He's such a good athlete that that can happen, and he can still recover. But against guys like Lockett and Richardson, I mean, they can match him in terms of speed. So those are the areas I would say to attack is, you know, both the cornerbacks. But you have to be able to, as you guys know, protect Russell Wilson from this defensive front. And the Eagles do have very good safeties in Malcolm Jenkins and Rodney McLeod.
Is there any chance we see the former Husky Sidney Jones this weekend as he works back from his Achilles tear? Where's he at in that process?
No, he hasn't returned to practice yet. So I think it could be any week now. It could even be this week, but I don't think he's ready to play in games. I think if the season was going a different way and they really needed cornerback help, or if they were like out of it and they wanted to definitely get him reps, maybe they would have rushed him a little bit more. But with the way the season's going, I don't know that he will even play in games at any point here. So it's sort of a week-to-week thing.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing you talking about this Eagles defense going against the Seahawks offense, because the Seahawks obviously want to pass the ball downfield. They want to have their explosive plays. And it feels like in a lot of ways, I mean, the Eagles probably are more like a 2012 version of this, but they're kind of like mirror images of each other, as these two teams. You know, Carson Wentz isn't quite as good of a runner as Russell Wilson is, but in a lot of ways, statistically, you look at them and they're very similar. And they've got this powerful kind of older running back who's playing really well, pounding the ball up the middle, a really strong defense who's good at everything. It's kind of amazing to see this team come to town and hope that the Seahawks are able to get something going through the air here. Do you have any other thoughts on this Eagles-Seahawks game before we do percentage chances of victory?
You know, I think one great matchup is going to be Jimmy Graham against Malcolm Jenkins. They were teammates in New Orleans, but Jenkins has been, just one of the best players on their team. One of the best safeties in the NFL. When they played the Cardinals, he covered Larry Fitzgerald in the slot. He can play the deep middle. He can play in the box. And he can cover tight end. So I think Graham's got, eight touchdowns in his last seven games or something like that. I think Jenkins against Graham is going to be a lot of fun. I'm trying to think of the other matchups that I outlined here. Michael Bennett going up against Lane Johnson and Brandon Brooks, the right guard. I think that's going to be a very fun matchup as well. And then I'm curious to see how they try to match up with Doug Baldwin, because they've got a nickel here in Patrick Robinson, former first-round pick, had totally not been meeting his expectations, his potential throughout his career, but they stuck him in here to play the nickel, and he's had an outstanding season. So I think that's going to be a lot of fun as well. And you nailed it with the explosive plays. I think the Seahawks are like fifth in terms of explosive passing plays this season. I think the Eagles defense is first in fewest explosive passing plays allowed. So that will probably end up telling the story of who wins this game.
How much have you been paying attention to the Seahawks in Philadelphia? Because I don't know if you knew this, but they figured out how to pass the ball to Jimmy Graham in the red zone now.
Yeah, I did see that. I was surprised. When did that happen? Well, I know I just remember from the spring, Pete Carroll saying like it's going to be a big emphasis for us this entire offseason and summer, and I was looking at his touchdown numbers. So yeah, I'm sure they'll go to him, and Malcolm Jenkins will at least have to try to match up with him down there. But in terms of overall how much I pay attention to him, you know, it's funny, I'll usually, if they're a later game and I cover an Eagles game and then I'm writing, there's sort of usually an area in the back where they'll have red zone on or something like that. So I like writing back there so that I can keep an eye on how they're doing. And if they have a Thursday night game or a Monday night game, I definitely watch.
All right, let's get to chances of victory here. You want to start, Shiel?
Sure.
This will be for the Eagles.
Chances of victory for the Eagles. You know, I was really surprised by the line, I must say. And I do a Monday column every week where I try to predict the Eagles line for the next week. And I had it at a pick 'em, actually. So that shows how much I know. The line was actually opened, I guess, at Eagles -6 and went down to -4. You know, I'm totally torn on who I think is going to win this game. But given that Vegas generally knows a little bit more than me, I guess I'll say 55. Maybe I'll go like 52% Eagles. Did I do that correctly?
Yeah, perfect.
That's what
you're, except you're not confident enough in the Eagles.
Yeah, that's your mistake here.
I look at this game and I definitely see some windows for the Seahawks to win it. I thought the spread was maybe a little bit too big, but at the same time, the Eagles are a better offense, a better defense. We didn't even mention special teams. They're excellent at punt returns. But the Eagles are kind of just a better team all around. The only reason we're really talking about this and thinking that it could be a close game is because it's in Seattle, which definitely means something. And I still feel a little bit confident in it. I think maybe just because of that underdog mentality, it's kind of nice having the Seahawks defense be like that. I like the idea of getting Carson Wentz into some third and longs. Maybe the defense pulls off a big play. I still think percentage chance is like 40%, though.
So we haven't talked about the most important element of this game.
Oh, no.
And that's the weather forecast.
Oh, God.
As we always know now, that we've become professional meteorologists here on the PelicanCast because of Russell Wilson's inability to play in the rain. Although really, against San Francisco, Russ wasn't sharp in the first half, but it was more his receiver's inability to catch the ball in the rain, somewhat surprisingly. And the good news is, currently, the extended forecast for Seattle for Sunday, AM clouds, PM sunshine,
there we go.
No rain in the forecast.
100% chance of victory.
Good. I'm excited to come back for some PM sunshine.
Yeah, this is not so nice on Friday and Saturday depending on when you get in.
Okay. Well, no, I think there definitely is a path to victory for the Seahawks. And just looking at those numbers that I was looking at today, where it's, I think, 113 of their last 116 games, they've either been within one score or held a lead in the fourth quarter. So they're so hard to put away. And I think the Eagles have not faced a quarterback like Russell Wilson, who, even if you pressure him, I mean, he's so used to playing with pressure in his face now with his improvisational skills, and that you have to really finish and bring him down. I mean, that's going to be a whole new challenge for them that they haven't faced. And then on the, on the other side of the ball, when the Eagles have it, you know, their offense has been fantastic. But like I said, I think there could be challenges with them in terms of running the ball. They turned the ball over quite a bit last week. They had 3 turnovers, 4 fumbles. So there could be something like that, a special teams play that really swings it in the Seahawks' favor. I think it's going to be a competitive game that comes down to the end in the fourth quarter. I don't have a prediction yet.
Yeah, it should be entertaining. I'm going to go with 45%. You talked me into it. I was literally leaning more towards 40% on this one. One last thing, though, Shiel. We couldn't let you get out of here without talking about Markelle Fultz, another of our old friends who ended up in Philadelphia after being in Seattle last year. What's the mood of Sixers fans about Fultz as he works back from the shoulder injury?
It's strange because I think in another year, this would just be this huge story that no one can stop talking about, but given that fans are now able to watch Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid every night and have a team that plays a pretty entertaining brand of basketball and moves the ball and competes on most nights, although as we're recording this, they did get blown out by the Cavs. But so it's been a little bit of an afterthought, Markelle Fultz. I think everyone's like, all right, let him get healthy, get mentally right, get the shoulder right, and come back whenever he is healthy and ready to go. But he sort of turned into this third storyline on the team, which is obviously very rare for a guy who's the number one overall pick. But I think that that's good for him. I think it should take some of the pressure off even when he does come back.
Yeah, and then nationally, Lonzo Ball has dominated rookie coverage. So yeah, Fultz, haven't heard much about him lately, and agree, hopefully he can get back and be effective. On that note, thanks so much for taking the time, Shiel. Really appreciated having you covering the Seahawks. And I guess give us a quick plug for The Athletic.
Sure, you can go to theathletic.com, or for us, it's theathletic.com/Philly. They're in a number of cities. They have college hoops coverage, a college hoops site, a college football site, doing some things with baseball with Ken Rosenthal and some other people. So a lot of quality content on there. No ads, no autoplay videos. It is a subscription site with a good app that moves really well. So hopefully people can check it out. And I'll obviously be writing a lot about the Eagles and Seahawks in the next week or so, including sort of 10 initial thoughts on the matchup. So that'll come out soon here.
What are the plans for The Athletic Seattle, Shiel? Can you share?
I don't know. We'll see. When I know something, I'll come back on and I'll be sure to plug it heavily. Okay,
we'll break it here. And then where can we follow you on Twitter?
Just @Shiel Kapadia. Yep.
Yeah, so we are excited for eventually, hopefully, an Athletics Seattle. But until then, I mean, no better coverage of Philly sports than what you guys are doing. And then, you know, also a lot of must-reads elsewhere in the country and some of the national stuff. I know the Bay Area, a really terrific site there that I was relying on last week as the Seahawks were preparing to play the 49ers. So it's definitely a great investment to subscribe in The Athletic, even if you're not specifically an Eagles fan. So thanks again for joining us.
You got it, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.